Welcome to another episode of the Svarim Chatter podcast. I'm Nachi Weinstein. This episode of the podcast is sponsored in honor of Dan Werlin's birthday by the Werlin family. Happy birthday, Dan. To sponsor an episode or support the podcast, please email me svarimchatter@gmail.com or see the links and information in the show's notes below. Additionally, please check out the show's notes for links to subscribe to the Svarim Chatter YouTube channel, the Svarim Chatter Substack, as well as the Svarim Chatter WhatsApp community. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on your favorite podcast listening platform, and enjoy the episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Susan Weingarten, who is an archaeologist, a historian, an author, and we'll be discussing her book, which is titled Haroset, A Taste of Jewish History, an intriguing exploration of one of the most mysterious symbolic Passover foods. And it's published by Toby Press, which is an imprint of Koren Publishers. And this is a look, you know, it's appropriate for this time of year. We're talking about right before Pesach, where, you know, everyone comes to the Seder and you eat the Haroses or Haroset, however you want to pronounce it. And it's something that's enigmatic. What is this food? There's different recipes, but where do the ingredients come from? What is the source? What are the origins of this? And Dr. Weingarten's book just traced this, and it's a really interesting book, and we'll get into that a little here on the podcast. So thank you, Dr. Weingarten, for joining me.
Okay. Nice to be with you, Nachi.
Let's start off. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I was born in England, and I made Aliyah over 50 years ago. I live in Jerusalem nowadays. I've got 5 children and 16 grandchildren. They should only be healthy. I started off as an archaeologist and got very interested in a lot of things that were written about Eretz Yisrael around the 4th century. And I got into the church fathers to see what they actually had to write about Eretz Yisrael and how far we could rely on them. I got very involved with St. Jerome. After I'd written my doctorate on Jerome and his picture of the Holy Land and whether we can rely on it or not, I got very tired of ascetic Christianity, and I decided I'd move to Jewish food. And the thing that actually put me onto Jewish food was a book called Women in Late Antiquity. And this book I remember reading it in the library and being absolutely stunned. We know a great deal about food in late antiquity. That's, you know, basically the 4th, 5th century, the beginning of the Yerushalmi, the end of the Mishnah. We know a great deal about food in late antiquity, but know almost nothing about how it was prepared. And I thought, this learned professor might know a great deal about classical sources. She might know a great deal about Christian sources, but she's obviously never opened Bavli Shabbat in her life. And I thought, wow, if she doesn't know anything, maybe other people don't know. And you know that there's a rule that anything you want to research, somebody must have written a doctorate about it in Germany in the 19th century. So this was more or less true. The only person that had written about food in the Talmudic literature was Shmuel Krauss at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th, the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And since then, almost everybody that wrote about Jewish food just relied on Krauss. He was translated into Hebrew very conveniently for those who don't understand the German. And other than a few archaeologists who looked at one or two finds, almost nobody had done anything about it. And on the other hand, there had been Eretz Yisrael at the time of the Mishnah and the Talmud, was a province of the Roman Empire. And there's a great deal of Greek and Roman influence on daily life, on influence on the architecture, and it was clear to me that there was influence on the food as well. Jews might have produced a kosher version of something, but they certainly knew something about the food of the major culture that was all around them. There's a very nice source, and I can't for the moment remember where it is, where they talk about a woman who goes away and leaves her pot on the stove and asks her neighbor to look into it, to look after it. And the rabbis say, no woman would be able to resist the temptation of lifting the lid and seeing what's inside the pot. And I think this is a mechanism of transfer of information about food, even though people, and perhaps not all of them, were keeping to the regulations of kashrut.
So how did you become interested specifically in this book, that you decided to write a book, an entire book? And an entire book, it is a small, it's not a massive book. It's around, I want to say, 150, a little bit more pages, and it's very readable, and you can read it in one sitting. So, you know, well, more or less, depending on one sitting, I guess. But I read it over Shabbos. In Charoset, or again, Charoset, how did you become interested in that you were going to research this food specifically?
Well, I was at a seminar. My daughter went to a seminar of Vered Noam, the woman who got Pras Yisrael in Talmud. And she said to me, Imma, you're interested in food. Vered is talking about food. She's talking about Pesach. And I went to Vered's seminar, which I enjoyed very much. And she asked me, do I know of any Greco-Roman food that might have been the origin of Charoset? And from there, I began to research. And I wrote one paper. And then I wrote a second paper. And when I wrote the third paper, my husband said to me, it's about time you write a book. And I will say that it's only Ashkenazim who asked me the question, how can you write a whole book about Charoset? Because Sfaradim are very aware that there are an enormous number of Sfaradi versions of Charoset. Ashkenazim just have one basic version with slight variations, but not many. Ashkenazi Charoset is based on apples. Sfaradi Charoset, on the other hand, is based on dates. And then in the middle, in the Balkans, in Greece and in Turkey, you have a charoset that's based on raisins.
Yeah, what you say is correct. I grew up on charoset. There's only one type. There's, you know, like you say, apples, little wine, cinnamon, some nuts. That's what it is. And there's another one, like you're saying. And I will say that the last chapter in your book is recipes from around the Jewish world, where you do include various recipes, oral history, oral traditions, which is really interesting. And we'll get to that at the end. That's something, you know, that's a very nice addition with you have, which you have pictures of you preparing and doing these recipes as well, which is nice. But let's start in the beginning. And something that you touch on in the beginning of the book, in the introduction, I think is important for us to also talk about here is Pesach food and Jewish identity or Jewish memory. And you talk about especially as using food to create prospective memory as well.
Yeah, there's a very nice book called Remembrance of Repasts. It's a pun on remembrance of the past, which is the way people translate Proust. And Proust talked very much about how eating something conjures up memories for us. And this book, Remembrance of Repasts, actually doesn't talk about Jews at all, but it talks about a Greek island and how the Greeks use food to conjure up memories. The Greeks also went through a diaspora, not as long as ours and not as, as complex, but this the same sort of phenomenon. And he talks about different sorts of memory. And he talks about inscribed memory and incorporated memory. And inscribed memory is just as it sounds. It's something that's actually written down. And but incorporated memory is something that belongs to the body and that the body remembers. And it's very interesting that right at the very first the very first source that we have about Pesach and Pesach Mitzrayim talks about what to eat and how to eat it and what you eat it with, and then says, and you shall do this each year again, and it'll be for you as a memory, so that the Torah itself is telling us that this will be a future memory. So you've got this fantastic telescoping of time in this bit in Sefer Shmot. I think it's chapter 12. I can't remember which parasha it is. But it says to us that we should be creating a future memory.
Yeah, which is something that again that you discuss as well in the book, and which is a really interesting thought and concept. So let's talk about the origins of charoset. This is something that first comes from the Mishnah. So we'll talk at the beginning of Chazal. This is something that you walk through in the book as well, going through the earliest sources of it and when it is first mentioned, where we first see it. Because as you say, you mentioned originally when we talk about the Pesach in the Torah, there's no mention of charoset. It doesn't come there. We don't see it till much, much later. In the Mishnah is the first time that we see any mention of it.
Right, exactly. I mean, we know that in the Torah, we're told about matzah, about Korban Pesach, and about maror, but there's no charoset. And then a long time later in the Mishnah, we get the first mention of charoset, and it doesn't tell us very much at all. It seems to understand that we should know what they're talking about. The only information that the Mishnah gives us about charoset is that it included spices. What happens after this? We get more information in the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi is interested in what charoset is like. It doesn't tell us what it's made of, but it talks about the texture, and it says, should charoset be thick, or should charoset be runny? And we get later on people who take notice of this, Sfaradim, who make their charoset in the form of little balls, and then bring it to the table and dilute it with wine so that it begins as being thick and ends up by being runny. And that's a way of using both opinions about the charoset. And it also talks about what charoset symbolizes. And it talks about the charoset as runny, as symbolizing blood. Now, this is something that over history has been left out of stories about charoset. You perhaps never thought of charoset as symbolizing blood. We don't know which blood it is. There's a lot of blood around at Pesach. There's the Nile turning into blood. There's the Korban Pesach and people dipping their bunches of za'atar, hyssop, and painting them on the doorpost so that the destroyer will pass over them. And there's also the blood of Brit Milah, which might just might be connected to it. But I think that Jewish experience has been such that one of the last things that we want to remember on a happy festival is blood. And in fact, the Taz, Torah Zahav, in the 18th century says you must not use red wine on Pesach because of the possibility that somebody might see this as blood. And he'd gone through pogroms, and there have been blood libels that the Jews use blood in their charoset, and all sorts of terrible accusations in the Middle Ages. And this has been completely left out of all modern discussions of charoset, and not so modern ones as well.
And as you say, that's something that comes from the Yerushalmi, the blood allusion that's referred to as blood. I will just say, going back, that the Mishnah is in Psachim, Mesachtas Psachim, Perek Yod, Mishnah Gimel. Says, if you lefon of a tabel b'chazeres, atchi makiel the frasas apas, if you lefon of matzah v'chazeres v'charoises. There it says, v'shnei tavshilin, avapish in charoises mitzvah. And it says, even though charoises is not a mitzvah, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Tzadok, a mitzvah, it is a mitzvah. So that's the first where we get it referred to in the Mishnah, and then as you mentioned, there's the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi also, interestingly, that's one Tana says that it's blood, but the other one in the beginning they call it that you duke, maduke, you grind it, and they pound it, and said that's why it would be. And there is actually, I think you mentioned in here that in the Yemen they still call it, they don't call it charoses, they call it duke. That's, is that how I'm pronouncing it right? Is that what they still call it till today?
Well, I don't know what they do in Yemen, but Yemenite Jews in Israel,
yeah, that's what I meant.
Certainly talk about duke. And when they discovered, I think it's a manuscript reading of the Yerushalmi, and people read it originally as something completely different, until somebody, it clicked with someone that what they're talking about is duke, which is what the Yemenites still call charoset till today.
Okay, so as you said, one of the opinions is that it's blood, referring to blood. But that, as you said, is not so well known, and that's not what we always know. And the other one, let's talk about the other source, is that it has to do with the mud or clay or the mortar of the bricks.
Right. That it's one of the explanations of charoset is that it's to do with, I think the word is probably clay rather than mortar. And I think mortar is because of a misreading of something, but it's got into certainly English speaking ideas that, yes, this is what charoset is. It's in memory of the clay. People, I remember speaking to the chef Claudia Roden about her charoset back in Egypt, and she says in Egypt we said that charoset had to be the same color as the mud of the Nile, and obviously this is relating a local relation to what it actually says in the Talmud.
Yeah, so that's more Yerushalmi, and then we get to the Bavli, which is what we haven't gotten to. And so the Bavli talks about why we dip in the maror, which is lettuce, why we're dipping it into charoses.
Right. We're talking about dipping it into charoset, and the Bavli is very certain that you shouldn't leave it there for too long, because this is going to take away any bitterness that the charoset has. And it's extremely interesting, because in what I think is the origin of charoset, the Greek dipping sauce, which was called embama, they do talk about embama as correcting bitter herbs. And the bitter herbs they use are the bitter herbs of the Talmud, which are lettuce, which in those days was much more bitter than nowadays. We've bred almost all the bitterness out of it. And endives, which are one of the five things that the Mishnah tells us that we can make bitter herbs of. And the reason that I identify charoset with embama is based on a fragment from the Cairo Geniza. In the Cairo Geniza, they discovered what's really basically a Mishnaic dictionary, a list of difficult words in the Mishnah, and they translated into Greek written in Hebrew letters, in fact. And they, in this dictionary, it talks about shafa charoset. He ground charoset, and it translates this as tribei embamos. He ground embama. And embama does appear in various Greek and Roman sources. It's made of different things. Sometimes it's made with vinegar and vinegar and mint, and in other cases it's made with vinegar, dates, rue, which is a bitter herb, and a whole lot of other ingredients, and it's called embama or oxyporum. And it's used, as they say, in order to stop the bitterness in the lettuce harming you. In other words, it's similar to what the Bavli is saying. The Bavli says that you shouldn't leave it too long in the charoset. You shouldn't leave your bitter herbs for too long in the charoset. And it also says the problem with this is that there's the kappa in the charoset. And kappa, they give various explanations for. Kappa might be a bug. Or kappa might be the juices in the lettuce which are harmful. It might also be a demon. But it seems to me that the idea that the lettuce has harmful juices and you therefore must dip it into the embama or oxyporum is very similar to what the Bavli is saying many hundreds of years later. The discussion of embama that I just quoted comes from a Greco-Roman cookery book called Apicius, which in the state that we have it now is from the 4th century, but in fact some of it goes back to the 1st century.
And that's really fascinating, and as you lay out it also in the book, but you know, the Greco-Roman parallel, food parallels, as you're saying there. But then we turn back to the Bavli, where the Bavli says, what's the mitzvah? Why charoses? And Reb Levi says, because l'zecher ha-tapuach, in memory of the apple. And Rabbi Yochanan says memory of the clay, which is what we were really referring to before, why it would be that kind of texture. And Abaya says, therefore, you make it acidic and thick, which we'll get into after. You know, we'll get into that a little bit soon. Is it acidic? Is it supposed to be sour? Is it supposed to be bitter? What is it supposed to be exactly? But the apple, and as you discuss this, it's really based on Shir Shirim, Ches Hey, which says, Mizois Oilem and Amidbar, Misrapekes, Aldoida, Tachas, Hatapuach, Eraticha, Shama, so what's going on? What's with the reference to the apple? And to be clear, we're also going to get into why, as you said earlier, many Ashkenazim, their charoses has apples. But we haven't gotten to the ingredients yet, and that's not what the Gemara is saying here, that necessarily that it should have apples. It's in memory of the apple.
It's so in memory of the apple.
Yeah.
I think it's Rashi who talks about the Midrash on Shir HaShirim. And the Midrash here about the apple tree is the story that when Pharaoh said that all boy babies were going to be thrown into the river, were going to be killed, the people of Israel, the couples separated from each other so that they wouldn't have any children at all, until, according to the Midrash, Miriam came to her parents and said, you know, Pharaoh wants to kill the boys, you're killing girls as well. You can't do this, soon there'll be no people of Israel left. And when the Jewish women heard this, they went out to seduce their own husbands under the apple tree. And they made love under the apple tree, and eventually the women gave birth under the apple tree. And in other words, in secret, away from the town, away from somewhere where Pharaoh's soldiers could pursue them. And the Midrash, this is a very beautiful Midrash. The Midrash says that God sent his angels to be their midwives. And because of this beautiful Midrash, which they associated with Haroset, we have the memory of the apple in Haroset.
But at this point, we don't necessarily have apples in the Haroset. So it's in memory of the apples, but there aren't necessarily apples included in the ingredients.
Right. Precisely. The very first sorts of Haroset that we find are Sfaradi Haroset, the ones that talk about making Haroset thick, and they make it thick with dates. And so Sadia Gaon, Rav Amram Gaon, both of them talk about they make it in our part of the world with dates. In other words, perhaps in other parts of the world, Haros is made with something else. But very interestingly, they also add vinegar. As you say, because in the Bavli they talk about Haroset being sour, so sourness is added with vinegar. And an awful lot of Haroset in ancient times was actually made with vinegar rather than with wine. In fact, the first person to add wine is Rashi, and the tradition is that he was a wine merchant. So he obviously found it easy to get hold of wine. Everybody else before him had used vinegar. I remember making some Haroset, one Purim for Mishloach Manot, and giving it to people and saying to them, look, Vanafoch, who try this as Haroset. And they were horrified. Because when you expect something sweet and you taste it and it's something sweet and sour, tasting more like a chutney, it really is very exciting.
And it's going back to the Bavli where we said Abaya says to make it acidic. And you know, in the book you do mention that in the Roman historians we know that they would say that they were horribly sour and they were so powerful to blunt the edge of a sword. So apples were not necessarily sweet. We think of apples, were they sweet or were apples sour? They're not necessarily sweet, depending on the apple. So there's that. Now, as you say, so let's move to the ingredients, really. And then, you know, as you mentioned, there's really a lot to get into, but where did the ingredients come from? What were the original ingredients? Original. Were there an original? What are the different sources of different ingredients for Haroset to go into it? And I don't think we mentioned the spices. There's a spice aspect of it as well.
Right. The spices are there from the time of the Mishnah. And it's very interesting because they very often tell you not to grind up the spices. Because if Haroset is there in memory of the clay, then the spices, they say, are in memory of the straw in the clay. You remember that the people of Israel were originally given the things to make bricks for Pharaoh, and then he suddenly stopped giving them the straw. And they had to go and find it for themselves, which was a great deal more work. So the straws in the bricks is very important. And the oven ground spices, things like sticks of cinnamon, perhaps, maybe later on cloves, were there to remind them of the bits of the straw.
So what are talking about the early, now what about the early ingredients, the different ingredients that we see?
The different ingredients. Well, I've already talked about the dates in the Sfaradi charoset and the vinegar. The Rambam, for example, talks about dates and he talks about treading dates. And very interestingly, one of my modern informants told me that her mother had told her that back in North Africa, people would come round before Pesach with very large palm leaves and dates, and they would stand there and tread the dates between the palm leaves for making the charoset. But how do we get Ashkenazi? Just before we leave the Sfaradim, we want to just mention the Rambam and his charoset. Now, the Rambam says that you should put hyssop, za'atar, in your charoset. Now, nobody else says this, but there is an ancient Greek recipe for embama which includes hyssop. Now, I don't know whether the Rambam knew this, whether he had a tradition, or whether he was simply saying, well, the hyssop is part of the story of Pesach Mitzrayim, and we should therefore put it into our charoset. Certainly, dates and vinegar and za'atar make a very interesting tasting charoset, if you can imagine that. But I want to move now to Ashkenazi charoset, the traditional Ashkenazi charoset, which, as you say, I remember, did you have a book called What the Moon Brought when you were a child?
Doesn't ring a bell, okay.
C.D. Rose Weilerstein. Maybe it's too ancient for you. But she had this little poem in her book where she says, apples, raisins, chopped up fine, cinnamon, nuts, and sweet red wine. And that is the typical Ashkenazi charoset. Now, how did we get to it? We got to it from the Tosfot. The Tosfot say you put in your charoset everything that the people of Israel are compared to in the Midrash on Shir HaShirim. So if you think of all the Midrashim that belong to Shir HaShirim, then you know that you put in nuts and you put in dates and you put in raisins and, of course, you put in apples, but you also put in pomegranates. Now, I just wonder how many Jews in northern France and Germany in the Middle Ages could get hold of pomegranates. And I had a look into this, and it's true that dried pomegranates were sold by pharmacies. But it's also true that the Queen of England, Eleanor of Castile, who came from Spain, was homesick for the fruits of her native land. So they bought her 20 oranges and 15 lemons, and I can't remember how many pomegranates. Now, if pomegranates was something that was so special that they made an enormous effort to get to it for a queen, I think it's a bit unlikely that they were actually pomegranates in Ashkenazi charoset. Maybe people in the south of Europe managed to get hold of pomegranates. I don't know. Today, the people that put pomegranates in their charoset are Jews who come from Persia. And I spoke to a lady who came from Persia. And she said to me, it's a terrible business, opening pomegranates on Pesach, because they're not in season and they've dried up. And it's very difficult, and it takes a very long time to do. You can preserve the pomegranates, but I'll tell you a secret, she said. When the pomegranates come in at Rosh Hashanah, I carefully put them into totally brand new clean jars and put them in my freezer, and they sit there till Pesach. Another Sephardi lady who came from Kurdistan told me that in fact the Jews of Kurdistan who have Sifrei Torah in a wooden box, and on Simchat Torah they pile the box with apples and pomegranates. And these particular apples and pomegranates are very carefully preserved until Pesach, and they use them to make the charoset. It's, I don't know, Malim Bakodesh or something, but it was difficult even in Persia and Kurdistan to get hold of pomegranates. So I suspect that it was much more difficult in Northern Europe. And when the Rambi Londres, the rabbi in London, talks about pomegranates, what he's doing is he's repeating a textual tradition, and he's not actually talking about what actually really happened. And so slowly, things get lost from the Tosfot idea of charoset. Pomegranates are hard to get hold of. Figs are another problem. And I can't remember who it is who talks about figs, but when you dry figs, they get covered with a sort of whitish dust. And people looked at the whitish dust and said, oh, maybe it's flour. Maybe it's something that could become chametz. You better not put figs in your charoset. So the figs were lost. And maybe they couldn't get hold of dates. And so you're left in the end with your typical Ashkenazi charoset without all the ingredients that the Tosfot talk about, but with everything that we are familiar with today.
The fig that you discuss in the book, I see on page 66, about the Ravya, and then the Leket Yosher, the student of the Trumas Hadesh, and he's talking about these issues with the dried, you know, like you're talking about. You see the
Yosher,
dried.
Right.
Yeah, it seems like flour.
In Germany, right? Yeah.
Yes. Germany, Austria, that area. And so interestingly, just to jump back and forth, so as you're mentioning, you know, these different, you really see the variations in the ingredients and how you can trace historically, sometimes because of what was available, wasn't available, how what we have, besides the different traditions. I want to just go back also just to mention here, as you point out in the book, the Rambam himself has different ingredients, different recipes from his commentary on the Mishnah to when he gets to Mishnah Torah. That's if a Rambam himself, he changes it. He does, you know, change. There is a distinction between the two. He himself, and then his grandson, Rav David Hanagid, also he himself changes the recipe. So there's the other recipe. There's different things included in there as well. And just he also says, just to point out, raisins, gourds, dates, sesame, and almonds. And then you put in the vinegar. This would be nothing like the charoset I know. I don't know what, like, that's be so far into what we have. And that's his, you know, what he says, and there's, you know, you quote others as well, many others, you go through really old Mepharshim talking about different one. There's also, we should mention maybe here, the as you call it, the haroset from the borderlands. So you have Provence, you have South France, and you also have Italy, where you have, they do it a little bit differently. They have a different kind of haroset there. And the one that, I don't know if you want to mention anything specifically about there, but the one that really jumped out to me was, I think it's Shivale Aleket, I think in Italy, they used to put
the Shivale Aleket, yes,
put flour,
exactly.
Actual flowers inside of it.
Right. And I was in the ghetto in Rome, and I met a Jewish woman there, and she told me that, yes, we put rose petals or rose jam in the charoset. The Shibulei Aleket talks about flowers, but And she told me that they were roses. Now, the Shibulea leket has another ingredient, which is very interesting and which is really exciting. The Shibulea leket says that you should put grit in your haroset. You should put a ground up piece of brick in your haroset. Now, he's the first person to say that, but he's by no means the last. And there still are people today who put grit in their haroset. Now, the Rabbi Menachem of Lanzano and following him, the Chida, look at this and say, how on earth can people do such a thing? It is absolutely ridiculous. We're supposed to be going from Evel to Simcha, and you're putting grit in your haroset. You're putting ground up bits of brick. They say any minute they'll be letting blood on Purim, they say. They have these wonderful objections, but it doesn't help, because people still today do it. And I went to visit a family who originated in Gibraltar, and they showed me that they take a little piece of pottery and boil it so that it's clean. And then with a hammer, they bang it and put just a very small amount into their haroset. And they showed me that it's written in their Haggadah that this is what you're supposed to do. It actually said it. And I saw the Haggadah where it was written. I can't remember if it was the Chida or Menachem of Lanzano. One of them gives a very reasonable explanation for this minhag. He says, clearly, what happened was that originally in a book or in a manuscript, it said, pound the haroset, and the tuff got left off, and it became pound the cheres, pound the potsherd. And this is clearly what happened. And so this crazy minhag, which is due to a misprint, has carried on all that time, hundreds and hundreds of years, just showing how traditional Jews are with their haroset. There's a whole lot of rabbinical discussions of minhagim that don't seem to have a basis for them to do with haroset. In Germany, it was common to use pears in haroset. And you get rabbis saying, I don't remember Am Yisrael ever being compared to pears. I don't understand this at all. But if it's your minhag, you better carry on keeping it. And in fact, the German minhag of pears was really quite interesting. I attributed it in the book to the Ari, but I later on found that there was somebody even before the Ari who talks about haroset and uses a pun. When Bezalel built the Mishkan in the wilderness, he talks about all the experts the Torah talks about all the experts that came in for the building of the Mishkan, and they talk about people who were talk about haroshet, and the people who were good at working in, and there's haroshet etz and haroshet evin, the people who worked in wood, who carved wood and who carved stone. And people made a pun on this. The Ashkenazi Jews punned on this, and they said, no, it's not haroshet etz, haroshet of wood and haroshet of evin. It's haroset etz and charoset even. And etz and even are the initial letters of the ingredients of charoset. So you get charoset even, which is aleph, apfel, apple, bet, birna, which is pears, and nun, nusa, which is nuts. So you have apples, pears, and nuts as your main ingredient. And then etz is ingbar and cimarind, ginger and cinnamon. So you have your Ashkenazi German, your German charoset with apples, pears, and nuts, and cinnamon and ginger. And in fact, we find illustrated Haggadot from medieval Germany with written on it the ingredients for charoset, apples, pears, and nuts.
Yeah, we didn't even get to the medieval art, and we'll get to that shortly. I want to just comment on a number of things that you said. First of all, that's a really nice one, the Chareshes Evan and Eitz, as you're saying. Is that in the book as well? I don't remember if I saw that.
Yeah, that's in the book, yeah.
It is. I guess I missed that. So talking about Ramdala, Menachem Di Lanzano, as quoted by the Chida, he was, as you quoted in the book, his incisive sarcasm, he was known for that. And he, as you translated, I'll read his full quote, you know, talking about putting the ground pottery, he says, "I was astounded to see something as crazy as this. Maybe now in the festival of Purim, they will go in for bloodletting in memory of the edict to exterminate all the Jews. Surely I meant to turn misery into rejoicing and the bad to good." And then he suggests what you said, that it was because of a textual error. You know, he was known for his work of the text. And he says, it's just ridiculous. It's just wrong to do something like this. Now, also, just interestingly, when we mentioned earlier Provence, I know in Provence you had Rabbeinu Menach ben Shimon Badarsi, and he, in his Sefer Menucha, he also talks about, interestingly, talking about, he's one of the one who mentioned, why we don't make a bracha? There's no blessing on Chareses, why we don't do that? And he suggests that he compares it, you bring down to the Arba Minim from Sukkot, and he says that everything is secondary to the lulav. We got a bracha on the lulav. He says, so there's the charesis is secondary to the mar. Make a bracha on mar, and the charesis is secondary. It's like tafel goes along with that, which is interesting to point out. So that's one thing. And then, yeah, we probably now should talk.
There's also the very interesting details of charoset from Lunel. Lunel, Yarchi, in Provence, in the south of France, and there is a recipe which was found in Tshuvot HaGaonim in a manuscript. It had just got stuck inside the book, I think, with a charoset which was made with gigantic quantities. 50 apples and 100 nuts. I can't remember. If you can find it, maybe you can give the actual details of it. But having talked about enormous quantities, they add the sentence which says, "And this is barely sufficient for us." So it's clear that what's happening here is that this is a charoset which is being made for a whole community. Now, we know that there was a yeshiva in Lunel at the time. I think Binyamin of Tudela talks about how the community looked after the people in the yeshiva and provided them with food and so on. And it seems to me that it's quite possible that they also provided them with charoset. Now, charoset was made with sometimes with very expensive ingredients. The spices certainly would have cost an awful lot of money. And perhaps not everybody could afford it. So we know the custom nowadays of kimcha de pischa, of people providing money for flour for people to bake their matzot with. But it seems that there was also a tradition that better off people or the whole community would provide charoset for other people. And You mentioned the illustrations in the Haggadot from Spain, and there are illustrations of a man who's obviously a rich man because he's sitting above everybody else under a canopy, and he's pointing to what's happening, and they're ladling out haroset and giving it, distributing it to people. And it actually says that on the top. He tells them to give people haroset. So that was clearly another community function. And it's possible that this recipe in Lionel for the large quantities of haroset is also for the whole community, as or for the yeshiva. It's not clear to me which.
I do have the recipe. So it's from Tshuvas HaGa'onim HaChadoshes, which is published by Professor Simcha Emanuel through Machon Ofek. And it's from Lunel, as you say. And they write, as you translate, it's actually the English. And it says, a reminder of how we make haroset on Passover. To a third of a hin of strong vinegar, we add fruit. 2 liters of white chestnut, which should be cooked before grinding. 2 liters of almonds, which should not be peeled. 30 small dates or 10 large ones. 800 nuts. 50 medium apples or 30 large ones. And if you reduce the chestnuts and almonds and add walnuts, it will be better and nicer. Which you say that has to do with them being, some are available, they were just freely available, and the other ones were more of a,
right.
You know, rare.
Chestnuts were available for free. They grew wild. And they become an ingredient in haroset.
And then you say, of spices, 1/2 ounce of ginger, 1/2 ounce of spikenard, sanbal, which is called ashbik, 1/2 ounce of kana, which is called canela, 1/2 ounce of tevin mika, which is called ashkinant, and 1/2 ounce of pepper. And this amount is barely sufficient for us, which is, you know, as you said, this, you know, is a large amount. And then we talked about, as you mentioned, you can see in the illustrated in the medieval art, you can see in some of these agadas, there are famous agadas, you can see them showing what was included in them. And as you mentioned with spices, and for those that haven't really talked about the history of spices much on the podcast, but spices back in the day, those merchants, you know, rich people dealt in spices. This is what they did. Spices was for rich people. You know, in Europe, they didn't have spices. This came from other countries. And so spices, this was very expensive. You know, you mentioned about pomegranates being expensive earlier, but to put in other cinnamon, other spices were expensive as well. So it's important to point that out. And we talked about the Ashkenazi. And then Ashkenazi moves to Sfarad. As you talk about Sfarad, the Rush and the Tor, they go south from Ashkenaz to Spain, and they bring with them their ingredients. We talked about Ashkenaz and the Leket Yosher, and why you talked about pears going in there. Also to note, as you mentioned, the Leket Yosher says pears are common here. Another reason perhaps why pears ended up is that they just grew there. And, you know, throughout the century, sometimes you just had to make use of what was there and what was available, and some things were not available. You couldn't use, even if that would have been, you know, quote unquote, better or more important for what you should have been using. So now I think we can also talk about, you know, bitter. And as you mentioned, bitter herbs. And is the haroset supposed to be sour or acidic or bitter or sweet? Like what we have it now, which way? There's been different ways and different opinions about what should be, how it should be, right?
Right. There are lots of different opinions. And there was certainly one time when the maror, the bitter herbs, were included in the haroset. There are various, in the Middle Ages, there are people who put what we would call chrein, horseradish, into the haroset, because haroset is supposed to have everything in it, says one of the commentators. It has a whole lot of things in it. And it's around the 14th century that the horseradish comes out of the haroset and onto the Seder table as maror itself. Because once you got further and further north and east, it was difficult to find the green leaves of the lettuce at that time of the year. Things were still a bit frozen in the ground. And if the horseradish was already inside the haroset, so this was something that people decided to use for bitter herbs. I still don't think that horseradish is really bitter. I'd call it sharp rather than bitter, but they called it bitter.
Yeah, and this is something that you mention. You quote especially the Raivan, and he is one of the Balei Tosfos, and he talks about the ingredient, and then he adds in that you should add in horseradish. I think it's miritich that you would be into horseradish. That it would be included.
There was somebody who talked about more drawer.
Ravya.
Yeah, Ravya, right. And he talks about moral drawer, flowing myrrh, it's translated. And the question is whether this was not a change from meretish, which looks very similar when written in Hebrew letters. So it's not, I couldn't work out which had happened first, whether the more draw was already there and then they used meretish, the horseradish, or whether this was a way of trying to make the horseradish more kosher by calling it more draw. I just didn't know. It was very unclear to me.
It's really interesting to see. And then you mentioned the Rekeach, Rabbi Elazar of Worms, and he says, he's the one who says, he's the first one to say that apples and nuts are the most important ingredients. And then he talks about making it acidic. And he says, for the spices, he says you should put in pepper and ginger together with it. And he also talks about the horseradish as well as karpas, which should be inside. And as you mentioned, he also talks about cumin, which was not common at the time to be inside of it. So I think what should be clear to the listener at this point is that there are so many different sources and different opinions for the ingredients, especially the recipe, the ingredients, what should be in there, what shouldn't. And therefore, that ties into what it symbolizes and what it doesn't, because some of these ingredients, go different ways with the different ingredients that are included in it. And as you mentioned, the blood aspect really gets left out. And that maybe has to do with, Sidi Rishami, but also really has to do with blood libel and ritual murder, blood libel accusations in Europe, and not wanting anything to do with that. That the Chorisa says nothing to do with blood. That's the furthest thing they want to have associated with blood. But as you did mention earlier, even if it is, some say it is, symbolizing blood, which blood? We don't know which blood is it supposed to be symbolizing. And you did say, interestingly, there is an interesting source of perhaps what it is symbolizing about one of the baby, the child, and you find the source for that it is from the Rishon of Elam in his something that he writes for Yotzer Shabbos Agadol. Maybe that's the blood that it's referring to. But regardless, it's not ending up really referring to that. But it did end up the Yitzchak Reis, you do mention having to do with blood libels. One of the blood libel ones, the Latin protocols in the Savoy trial, you say the Jews handed over the said children to be killed and made their heads and intestines into a paste or food, which is called Chareisa. They call it, it's a different word here, but it's made for all Jews to eat, and which said food the said Jews eat at Passover instead of the Passover sacrifice. So there were accusations of this, that the Chareisa was having to do with blood libel, and this was the blood. So, and then in the end of the book, we're getting towards the end, and something that you discuss in general is that you discuss Chareisa moving towards modernity, and as well as, today, you talk about modern and different recipes. So how is that, what was that like? That's a totally different research. So your book kind of includes textual research, and then you had the oral research, the traditions, and talking about different traditions that people from different backgrounds have for different recipes of Chareisa.
Yeah. What really amazed me was the continuity between modern recipes and some of the ancient recipes that I found. I would hear women, mostly women, although sometimes it's the man who makes charoset, because if charoset might be a mitzvah, you don't leave it just to the women, unlike most of the rest of the cooking for Pesach. I went to families where both of the couple made it together. There was a lovely Yemenite family, I remember, where they were making their charoset together, and I watched them make it. I had to do a lot of organization, but I went round to visit and photograph people, making their haroset. And yes, they would sometimes talk about things in the same words that I found in the texts. As I say, the idea that haroset should be thick, so they made haroset into balls, and they then would dilute it and make it runny with wine. And this disappeared from Ashkenaz, but I found Sephardi families who are still doing it, who still make haroset in the form of balls and then dilute it at the table with red wine, which of course the Ashkenazi Jews wouldn't do in the days of the Taz, but have gone back to doing now. And yeah, it was certainly very enjoyable, both watching the people making haroset and talking to them on the phone about how they made it and what they did and what their tradition was. I must say that I really enjoyed that part of the research. My supervisor, Professor Aaron Oppenheimer, was a Zichrono Livracha, a Jew whose family came from Germany to Eretz Israel before the state. And I asked him what he put in his haroset. And he said to me, "I don't know," he said. "We never ate it. The Yekas have a minhag of dipping their maror into the haroset. And then because of what it says in the Bavli, that you mustn't leave it there and it might lose its bitterness, they shake it all off and they don't actually eat it. They only eat the maror." And I asked his wife what she put in her haroset. And she says, "Aaron never eats it," she says. "I just buy it."
Wow. So you really see the difference. It's something that really differs from tradition, you know, to tradition, people with different backgrounds. And in the last chapter of the book, you do mention you have haroset from England. Then you have from Italy, you have a recipe. And these are all recipes. You explain and you give the recipes from Gibraltar, Greece, Turkey, Georgia, the country, not the state. From this, you write haroset from the stands, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Kurdistan, Persia, Tehran. You have from some other places here that I'm not even sure. Syria, Iraq, Iraqi diaspora, Israel, Egypt. And you have different variations because you have somebody's Ruchama Chayun Sephardic haroset from Cairo, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, Yemen, yeah, and so really, New Zealand, Germany really have, you know, as you mentioned, you really have, and I love how you add in, you have in your, this is the last one is the best, what you just mentioned. You write, "Haroset from Germany, Aaron Oppenheimer's untasted Yekish haroset, the ingredients unknown." And you talk about it and you give the story that you just mentioned, which is really, really, really cute. And you do have the other, you know, the other kind of recipes as well. You go through it. So really, there are a number of recipes. There are numbers of pictures. And by the way, the pictures in this book, there are the pictures of the recipes as well as the pictures of when you talk about medieval art and some other things. There are color pictures, which are very nice. They're included in a section all in color, which is nice. Like I mentioned, the book it's a short book. So about 160 pages, hardcover. And you can, you can read it. It's very, very interesting, a really readable book. This price is $24.95. I will include a link in the show's notes where you can, any listeners who are interested can buy it. And I don't know if you have, Dr. Wangard, anything else you wanted to add? Or
Well, I don't think so. I think we've pretty well covered a large number of things in the book. And anybody who wants anything more can have a look in the book.
Yes, and you know, really interesting. I found something that is something that we do every year at the Seder Yukam, but it's not something that you necessarily know a lot about. You know, people are, there's a lot of things like this, a lot of traditions and a lot of mitzvahs and things that we do and traditions that we're just not sure of what it is that, where did it come, the way that we do it today, especially when it comes to food, which is so interesting. Where, how did we get to this food today? And as you see, especially in the back, when the ingredients, the variations, especially among Sfardim, are wide ranging. There's many differences. Ashkenazim, as you say, not so much. But it's really interesting to learn more about and to learn where it came from and how we have what we have today. So thank you very much for joining me to talk about this, and Chag Kosher V'Sameach to you.
Yeah, right. As they say, you have to have a happy Pesach and a kosher Purim.
Exactly. Thank you very much for joining me. Where it came from and how we have what we have today. So thank you very much for joining me to talk about this, and Chag Kosher V'Sameach to you.
Yeah, right. As they say, you have to have a happy Pesach and a kosher Purim.
Exactly. Thank you very much for joining me.